Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and this is a regular old episode. This one's about a Hugo nominee, Hugo finalist, which is Glory Road by Robert A. Heinlein, which was one of the 1964 finalists for the Hugo. And for this podcast, I have James Hedrick from the podcast Something About Dragons. Hi there, James. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Seth. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. I think you reached out when you were kind of just getting your podcast off the ground. So I want you to tell people about yourself, about the podcast.
Oh, yeah. So it was one of those things. I love listening to podcasts. I listened to Hugo's There for a while. I listened to a whole bunch of other history and variety podcasts. I used to have quite the long commute, so it was a nice way to spend the time on the train and going into D.C. And I was looking around for a podcast about fantasy books specifically. I really like, you know, your Tolkien's, your Eddings, et cetera. And I really liked that. And I looked around and there's just not as many sort of podcasts about fantasy as you would think there should be, or at least I thought there should be. And so I thought about it. And one of the things that I thought was, you know what, I'd like to go back and read some of the older fantasy books, sort of start from the beginning. And that's sort of what became Something About Dragons. I started in 1900 with things like The Wind in the Willows and, you know, books like that, a lot of kids books, kind of late Victorian type of stuff. And then kind of working my way through the 20s and the 30s and then getting into pulp right now. And, you know, pretty soon I'll get into the middle of the century and everything starts to get weird and we get science fiction and space opera crossovers and like the book we're going to talk about today. And so that was kind of my thing. I decided I had a little free time on my hands. I was a former federal employee, and if anybody knows what's going on with federal employees right now, there's less of us than there used to be. And I was one of those people. And so I took some time and put this idea that I've been having for a while together and putting it out there and trying to keep it regularly updated. So we'll see how that goes now.
The thing that I have learned from listening to your podcast, which I'm really enjoying, by the way, I'm not necessarily reading along with everything, but I of still course, enjoy kind of hearing you break it down, is just like how long it took for fantasy to be a named genre.
Yes. I thought that was really interesting too. It was something that I sort of knew a little bit about, but you sort of reading into it, you know, there's sword and sorcery, or it's, you know, they talk about the fantastic, or they talk about romances. Tolkien called everything that he wrote a romance. And so you get so many of these people, and it's not until you get really into the 60s and mostly when they published Tolkien in paperback that fantasy becomes a genre sort of in the commercial sense that we think of it. And so it took a long time. So, I mean, there wasn't even a word for it for most of the time that I've been covering.
Stories, right?
Fairy stories is what Tolkien called it in his academic work. One of the episodes is a whole discussion of the essay of On Fairy Stories by Tolkien. Yeah. And then the one he wrote on Beowulf. And both of those, he refers to romances and fairy stories. He talks about the act of fantasy, creation of fantasy, but not as a genre.
Even science fiction's that way, right? Where you have all the old school pulps that were planetary romances, right?
Planetary romance, big one. That's one that gets thrown around. Yeah, it doesn't really solidify until really middle of the 20th century at best is when you start to really get the commercial. And I think, you know, I don't know how much interest, it's interesting to me, but it, you know, it's the commercialization and you start to get the paperbacks, I think, is where you really start to get the publishing starting to define what science fiction is and what fantasy is, and you get a commercialization of the genre.
So kind of at the risk of, I think I mentioned to you that my idea for doing a podcast called Foundational Fantasy, kind of talking about where people got connected to the genre. Do you want to talk about like where did it come from for you?
I really liked that idea, and I think that, you know, I think that everybody, you know, if you're in a genre, a speculative fiction genre, if you like science fiction, if you like horror, if you like fantasy, everybody has a book or a time that they got into it. I've been reading, you know, fantasy forever. I mean, mine's not as interesting as it might otherwise be. My grandmother got me a copy of The Hobbit when I was a kid. I couldn't have been more than 7 or 8 years old, probably. And just such a good introduction into fantasy literature to read The Hobbit at the age in which you're probably old enough to understand, you know, most of the word. It's not a terribly dense or difficult to read book in terms of the verbiage, but being able to read it and having that story, and it's a great adventure story, and it's a great story the second time you read it, and the third. And I think I can't tell you how many times I've probably read The Hobbit. And I just, you know, I loved it. I loved the whole idea of there being a secondary world out there that, you know, was interesting and fun and full of spiders that you could stab and
you know,
throw rocks at and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed that. And of course, Tolkien, you know, The Hobbit's really good because it's very much written as a children's book. And Bilbo is a really good stand-in for the audience. But yeah, it's one of those. I read the Hobbit, and then I couldn't get enough. I read Tolkien. I read Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court. I did that. You know, that was a big one. I really enjoyed. I read a lot of Mark Twain as well. He has a lot of fantastic-y stuff, you know, outside of the books that most people would know. And then I just, you know, I got into it. I read Eddings. I read Piers Anthony. Wouldn't recommend that one to anybody, but. sorry, Pierce. You know, I read a lot of just anything with dragons on the cover that was about 900 pages. You know, mm-hmm. Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn was one of my favorites when I was a kid. It didn't take me long. I think I was primed and ready for it. So I dove in head first, hadn't come back up since.
Yeah. So it's interesting that you know you're a fantasy fan, and you had mm-hmm. pitched some kind of fantasy books for us to talk about today, and then you're like, hey, how about we do like the one Heinlein fantasy book?
Oh God! This book, it Glory Road, it is such a quintessential Heinlein novel, and then it is also such a he's writing outside, you know, of his normal genre, the normal genre of sci-fi, but it reads exactly like everything else he ever mm-hmm. you know he ever read. It's not a it's not a very wide departure for Heinlein, but it is a really, you know, I think it's an interesting insight both into. I think it could be somewhat of an interesting insight to him as a writer and then sort of where the genre is at the time. So he's blending a bit of that, you know, like he would planetary romance, a little space, old school space opera.
Yeah.
And, you know, his digressions. And then I think he just wanted to talk about dragons for a while. I really think that was all he wanted to do.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to look at what it was up against in 1964.
What was it up against? I remember looking at this the other day.
So in 64, it was up against Way Station, which was the winner by Clifford Simak, and then Witch World by Andre Norton, the original Dune World, which was the serialized version of Dune.
The serialized version of Dune, yeah.
And Cat's Cradle by Vonnegut.
By Vonnegut. So,
yeah.
And it was, here you go, the Way Station by, was the one that won it. That's, mm-hmm. wow, that's a, yeah. oh, that's, he's definitely number five, I think, in that particular list of finalists.
So just kind of big picture, you know, Wikipedia calls this a science fantasy, right? It's not even like real. It's the most science fiction fantasy book that I've read in quite some time.
It is definitely a fantasy book written by a science fiction author who's not particularly interested in fantasy. I don't think that's a hard. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. And of course, you know, we're not going to get into spoilers. I guess we won't get spoilers quite yet. But
yeah.
it definitely goes planetary real fast. And then the latter third or half of the book is almost entirely what you know what you would think of as a standard sci-fi or a standard sci-fi setting. Anyway.
Yeah. So what was it about this one that kind of made you want to talk about it?
Well, I really do like this book, and I'm probably going to criticize it a bit more than I think is than you might otherwise think, or you know, for someone who says to be a fan of this book. I really do like this book. It's enjoyable if you like Heinlein. It's definitely sort of a second tier one of his books, but it gives, you know, he's trying something a little different, and it's one of those kind of books that's really, if it's your favorite book when you're 14, that's fine. If it's your favorite book when you're 34, you might need to reexamine, you know, your approach to literature.
Yeah.
But it really does kind of, you know, the book in and of itself, I think he's trying something interesting that Heinlein doesn't usually do, which is he's writing about nostalgia. This is a book that's ostensibly about nostalgia, right? There's multiple times, you know, Scar Gordon, E.C. Gordon, the main character, he comments one time, you know, Heinlein can't write a book without mentioning Barsoom. You know, so he talks about the moons of Barsoom. Every book he ever wrote talks about the moons of Barsoom. And so he talks about falling into a book, right? The main character talks about falling into a book. And it's really, this book is a book about nostalgia and about how you know, it's even kind of, there's an approach to it where it's kind of written to and about fans of science fiction and the fantasy genre is people that kind of like wish that that type of adventure existed in the world. And it also spends a little time before we get to spoilers, poking kind of fun at them and deflating that bubble a little bit. But there's a thought here about what does it mean to really engage with the material, engage with the genre, and think about, you know, do you really want this or is this a really fun escape for you? And I think that Hyland is trying to get at that. It would be nice if he focused on that and stopped focusing on several page diatribes about sex, but he is, yeah, he is trying, I think, to talk a little bit about the nature of the genre and the nature of what it means to enjoy fantasy and science fiction and speculative fiction. So it's one of the reasons I enjoy the book, is he's doing something a little bit different. And, you know, it's still a fun adventure story if you want to read it that way. And then there's a little more to it if you want to kind of give some thought to what he's trying to say to you.
Yeah. And I'll say I more or less enjoyed this one.
I think that's the appropriate level of enjoyment. So I think it's the appropriate level of enjoyment.
And I was enjoying it for what it was. And then it kind of shifts 2/3 of the way in. And I thought, oh, I thought we were done. And I was going to be like, that was really fun. Along the lines of his lighter stuff like Farmer in the Sky.
Oh yeah, it definitely has that kind of vibe.
Or any other, like it reminded me a little bit of The Wizard of Oz, because it's, you know, go to place, have conflict, have fight, you know, go to another place.
Yes, silly.
and it's kind of a portal fantasy as well, which
it very much is, yeah.
Yeah. And then the latter third of the book was where I kind of went, I'm not sure that I'm liking this anymore. We can definitely get to that in spoilers.
Absolutely.
There's an Alaska connection in here. I'm from Alaska originally, and it talks about, I think his mother is on Elmendorf Air Force Base, which is in Anchorage, which is where I grew up. That's where we went to the air shows when I was a kid. How about just a real quick non-spoiler, what is this book actually about?
Yeah, so real quick non-spoiler is that E.C. Scar Gordon is the main character, and it's told from his point of view. It's entirely in the first person, and he is involved. It's a early 60s setting, and he's obviously involved in a war somewhere in Asia that is not Vietnam, quote unquote, not Vietnam. This is absolutely a book about Vietnam. Yes. It's not Vietnam. And he is stuck there because he can't avoid the draft. He goes to his draft board. He says, take me. He goes into Vietnam. And he ends up seeing a whole lot of combat and finally gets out, gets out of combat, gets discharged, and ends up in Europe hanging out, where he meets a beautiful woman that is described for several pages of very purple prose. unfortunately, a little over the top, even for Hyndlin.
Well, he didn't expect you to just believe him that she was the most beautiful. He had to go in excruciating detail.
Excruciating detail. And then tell, you know, it's that old show, don't tell. But in this case, Hyndlin wants to show it, tell you, and then tell you again. But he meets a beautiful woman, and that begins the adventure that he goes. And they end up at first on a world that's not Earth, but is very much medieval-ish Earth, or maybe ancient Roman-ish Earth. There's a few adventures there. They eventually, you know, they go to another world. They hop to another world. There's some dimensional hopping here, which is very interesting, I think. They get to another world. They go up. They find, and they finish the quest. They get the thing, and that's not the end of the book. I think that's what you were saying with it sort of ends 2/3, and the back half of the book, or the back third of the book, is all about what happens to a hero after the quest is done, right? And that's kind of, you know, in your standard fantasy, you know, in the early 20th century, right? You go to the place, you have the quest, you win the thing, you come back, and we all live happily ever after. Or in the case of Tolkien, everyone else lives happily ever after, and you get to go to the Grey Havens, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And so it spends a little bit more time, you know, sort of on what happens after the adventure is done part of it. And that gets to a little bit of Hyndlin moralizing that, you know, anyone that's read him will know he tends to fall into. But it's an interesting approach to it because it really does try to focus on that and really explore, you know, what is the nature of the quest and what is the nature of heroism after you're all done with it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the quick elevator pitch, non-spoiler.
Yeah. And I liked just as a Gen X person, the fact that he found this quest essentially in the want ads. Right. In the paper.
And the one ends in the paper.
It reminded me of The Equalizer, which is a show in the 80s, you know, and now there's movies and there's like a reboot TV show as well. But like it was a want ad, you know, do you need help, you know? And this one, like, it is so detailed about matching up with his perfect kind of Marty Stu character.
Oh, yeah.
You know, are you the champion? You know,
are you an alpha? Oh yeah, exactly. Are you, you know, should you have your own podcast and be talking about it? It's really funny. I think it's like Hyland is occasionally funny and occasionally thinks he's funny and really isn't. But I have to say that the one ad piece always really amused me, because not only is it the one ad, are you a coward, is the thing on the title, but it's then he turns away and he tries to get away from, like, he reads the one ads and he's like, oh, that looks a lot like me. I'm not going to do that now. And then he turns around, he finds the one ad in this lockbox, you know, are you a coward? Right. And then he sees it on the street, you know, are you a coward? And he's like, all right, I give up. I'm like, the call to adventure has come. I must answer.
Yeah.
So it was actually a pretty good bit, I thought, in the middle of the book or the beginning mm-hmm. of the book.
I say we just go ahead and dive into spoilers, because, you know, this is a 60-year-old book, and so people can check it out if they want to. If you want to get it, the audio version is like 9 hours. I did most of this one on audio, so it makes it so it's – anytime I do primarily audio, I don't have as many notes because it's by the nature of listening to an audiobook while I'm driving, you know, I can't take down any notes that I want to talk about.
Please don't take notes while you're driving. Yeah.
No, it's not a good idea. So I don't have a ton of stuff written down, but yeah, like I said, don't be spoiled. If you're a fan of Heinlein's work, you'll probably enjoy this one. I'd be curious to hear from people who like his other work and how this one compares. So yeah, mm-hmm. let's go ahead and go into spoilers. Let's talk more about the characters, because we mentioned Scar, who ends up going by Oscar, because he's essentially asked his name and he says, oh, I'm not sure, like an Idiocracy. But he goes, oh, Scar, you know. Yeah. So now his name is Oscar.
Now his name is Oscar. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I believe his original name is Evelyn Cyril. So I think he says something in there. It's like, you might as well get rid of that one and work in much anyway. Right.
That is a very like 50s male name, right?
Oh, yeah. You don't get names like that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Star.
And Star, yeah, who I guess we're into spoilers, so we can say who she eventually becomes. And Star is the beautiful woman that he meets on the beach in Island and off France, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, I think he was in Nice, right?
But Nice, yeah. And so she ends up being, as you find out later in the book after the end of the quest, that's what the back third of it is about, is that she is the empress of the universe, for lack of a better term, called her wisdom, or the wisdom, or her wisdom is her title. And she ends up being the empress of the universe and needs a hero to go capture basically a supercomputer that holds the identities of all previous universal emperors and empresses. And that's what they go and they find in the tower, protected by an entity called the Eater of Souls, which got to be pretty good. It's a pretty good name for a bad guy, honestly.
Yeah.
And then there's Jocko is the only other real character that shows up. Well, it's a couple of side characters, but Jocko, who is Scar's Batman, I suppose, his backup guy.
No, that's Rufo you're thinking of.
Oh, Rufo. I'm sorry, not Rufo. Jocko Jocko is the character that they meet on the first planet. Yeah, sorry, Rufo is that character, and he ends up being, I believe, the grandson of the Empress by some weird connection that's genetic mm-hmm. there. And those are the three that go on the quest, and Rufo ends up being his backup guy, and they go through, they meet Jocko on the planet that's sort of a stand-in for medieval England, and they have some adventures there. They kill some dragons, golems, and they go through there, and then they get to the tower where the Eater of Souls protects it, and they fight a bunch more golems with ray guns and lasers, and there's a mental fight in the middle of tower. They grab the MacGuffin, for lack of a better term, and then they head back, and then they escape. And there's sort of, I think, as you were saying earlier, that's kind of where the story should end, or you think the story, you know, is going to end.
Yeah, it's the big reveal, right?
Yeah. That's where he finds out that she's the empress of the universe, essentially.
Yeah, he had been sort of assuming she was a princess of some kind. You know, she's Princess Leia, essentially. They're basically, you know, having to go through the trash compactor with her. in this case, it was a golem. I found a lot of the early going of the book charming. It was just fun. It is an adventure book that I think I would have liked as a kid. And, you know, he gets to this planet. He accepts the adventure, and she's like, I'm sorry. You're probably going to die, because nobody's ever survived a match with, I can't remember what the name is.
Igly, I think, is his
Igly,
name.
Igly. Yes, and with Igly. An Igly. And I really enjoyed the description of it, because I was picturing a golem just being made of rock, but it essentially looks like a large hairy man.
Yeah.
And so he has to figure out, and he makes this grand plan about, okay, I'm going to lure him down to the water. And then at just the right time, we'll push him into the water and we can drown him because he probably can't swim. And that does not work out.
Does not work even a little bit. No.
Yeah. And so those fights are fun. And like the inventive ways of somehow folding the golem up smaller than it could possibly be, right?
Feeds himself his own foot and then keeps going. Yeah. That was there.
It reminded me of a Labors of Hercules kind of solution to something.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a really good, I mean, Heinlein is very much, you know, a student of, you know, ancient history, you know, the classical histories. So that's probably a good connection to where he would have pulled some of his material like that. And it was, I think you're right, like there's some very inventive kind of fight scenes in there, right? He goes after the dragons and there's a whole, he fights the Igli, the construct, and feeds him his own foot and then slowly feeds in the rest of himself until he disappears, right?
Yeah.
And there's a whole line of other angry looking animals sitting there watching him fight the Igli as he tries to push him off and drown him. So that one is really good. He fights the dragons and he figures out that they can't breathe fire that long because it's a swamp gas thing. And you know, there's a big bit in that. And so they, you know, sneak.
And the dragons are funny because they're much more science fiction dragons than they are fantasy dragons, right? Because it goes out of its way to say, well, no, it's, you know, glands essentially that push out these gases that ignite, right? And it reminded me of Reign of Fire, the Christian Bale movie. Because they talk about the mechanics of that. And I'm like, well, that's a science fiction way of talking about dragons.
it absolutely is. And it's right. You know, it just struck me as pure golden age science fiction, right? Where you have to stop for a minute and explain how the weird thing works, right? You know, Heinlein does this in you know, all the Lazarus Long books when he talks about faster than light travel, right? Mm. And he explains it and then he hand waves it. So in pure science fiction fashion. But it is a very much that approach, yeah.
And the other kind of science fantasy part of it is Star starts telling him about, I think she calls it metaphysical geometry.
Metaphysical geometry. Yeah, everything is a math metaphor for the magic in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there is magic, but it's more of a science-y magic.
Yeah. And, it's all drawing pentagrams, but you have to make the right pentagram, right? She draws a very specialized, you know, five-pointed star. And then they have they had the box, right? They had the luggage that they carried with them. And in my mind, if you're a fantasy fan, you've read Terry Pratchett, right? And in the Terry Pratchett novels, Rincewind the Wizard is followed around by an animated luggage that is bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. Mm-hmm. Right. And they are carrying a luggage, but they in real science fantasy fashion have to unfold it and it unfolds to bigger than it is. You don't just open it and it's magically bigger, like a bag of holding. It unfolds in a certain way is to make it bigger. So it's a very everything that's come across has this kind of metaphysical geometry, math metaphor explanation for it.
Yeah.
And I think that's very much in Heinlein's vein.
Yeah.
You know, even when he's writing about dragons.
Yeah. So there's some gender politics stuff here that you're always going to encounter in older science fiction and fantasy, right? Sometimes I just shake my head and I'm like, you know, he's Oscar is trying to be pretty honorable, right? Like he's not wanting to just sow his wild oats, right? And he's like, well, I like this woman. And so when he's presented with three women that come seeking him at night, he's like, pass, you know?
Yeah.
that of course offends Jocko. Mm-hmm.
Offends Jocko on none of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, a little bit of warning about this kind of stuff could have gone a long way.
I'm just saying that, you know, the both Star and Rufo talk about how much time they spend on Earth, particularly Rufo, you know, mentioned it seriously, and no one thought to give Oscar a heads up.
Yeah.
You know, that really seems like if you're named Her Wisdom, you might want to figure, you know, I want to think ahead on that one.
She just didn't think she needed to, she didn't know how backward he was, but, you know, so he's trying to be honorable and stuff and eventually proposes and they try and figure out what kind of marriage ceremony can they do? Do they have access to the right kind of clergy or something? And like, they finally settle on, well, we can jump over your sword.
Yeah.
And he almost immediately announces his intention to occasionally beat her. And I'm like, what?
Well, oh my, so gender politics of Glory Road. They're not great. I don't think even you can give it the usual, it was the 60s kind of pass on that, because a lot of that just comes, you know, you, And this is something you encounter, you know, in reading early fantasy as well, too. Like, Voyage to Arcturus has some of this in it, David Lindsay. And it's like, man, you're going there. You're trying to be more progressive, quote unquote, than the times that you're living in. But every now and then you'll get something like that. Yeah, where it's, you know, thrown off as an offhand line about beating somebody. And it's just not, it throws you out of, at least it throws me out. And it's one of those things that you just kind of, you don't have to accept it. That's not what I'm saying, but it's hard to read past it, and it's hard to sort of, I think, accept that and read through. And you're like, yeah, you're reading somebody who has some very regressive gender politics in it, when he's trying to sort of be, you know, he's got a, you know, strong, quote unquote, strong female character, you know, sitting right there. Even if you look at some of his other work, Friday is a really good example where he has a female main character, and it's a spy novel, essentially, right? Sci-fi spy novel, Friday. And, but the end of it, the resolution of the story for the female main character there is to be pregnant and have a child and settle down. And you're like, just read 200 pages about how awesome she is at whooping up on people, and okay, all right. So the fulfillment of her life's goal is to settle down. And so,
well, yeah, and there's a couple other things where, like, he described how able she is and how, you know, she's kind of an Amazon woman and stuff, and how she can take care of herself. And he sets that in the context of, well, it'd be hard to rape her. Because she could fight somebody off. And you're like, what? That's just okay.
That can't be the line, man. That can't be that can't be the level you're trying to get over.
That's not the benchmark, just, right?
Yeah. No, it shouldn't be. It's got to be higher than that. And it does. Not a good example, but it's definitely a relevant example of how it goes. And it's just that, like, you can make these points even then without kind of resorting to that, but that's the mindset in which you're sort of in which they're sort of existing. And I think you see it. Yeah. You see it in Heinlein. Heinlein's bad about that. The Lazarus Long, I think Time Enough for Love has some of that in there too, where he ends up knowing someone from when she was a child and ends up marrying her when she gets old enough, but it's totally hand waved. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, that just, almost every Heinlein book I can think of has at least some example of that. And this one's no, you know, it doesn't miss on this. There's a whole thing about how he doesn't want to sleep with anybody when he's in Asia because they all look like children, and it's just dwelled on way too much.
Yeah.
For it to be really that, you know, you're sitting there going, okay, man, we got it 3 pages ago. You know.
Yes.
It's going to be uncomfortable for a lot of modern reading. It really is.
Yeah. And to be fair about the grooming thing, like you're kind of talking about, knowing somebody from when they're a child. It's kind of inverted here because Star has had her eye on him for a really long time and has been, you know, specifically training him to become this hero.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a little weird.
It was a little weird. And I think if this were written by someone now, you know, if it were written by a modern author, they might have explicitly made that the case, right? You watch this reverse grooming, for lack of a better term, right? In the non-sexual sense, but in the sense of like trying to create, you know, what you need out of someone. And I think that that's an interesting part in the latter third of the book when Oscar has this conversation with Rufo, and Rufo clues him in, right? He basically leads him, Socratic method leads him to, like, dude, she played you from the start, right?
Yeah.
The reason that you were in Asia is because she kept you from getting into college, right? That was the, you know, subtext of it. The reason that you kept getting busted back to corporal and leading patrols is because she kept making people bust you back to corporal and lead patrols, right? And so there is this whole bit of she put you in harm's way for years and controlled your life for years so that you could potentially, you know, so that you could reach your full potential, right? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that disappoints me about this book a little bit is that Heinlein gets to that point, right? He goes through, he shows like the aftermath of heroism, the aftermath of the quest, and he leads Oscar to that point, right? Wherein you have every reason to be upset, right? Very, very upset in this case. And then pulls it back. He doesn't take it to the point of like having a full break or having some sort of actual drama, you know, in the literary sense between somebody that has literally, you know, yeah, they gave you every reward you could have wanted for the performance, right? You did what you said you were going to do, and you got the girl, and you got the money, and you got to go see, you know, the universe, right? But it never leads to this break of, like, that's a pretty big betrayal, right?
Yeah.
And I think that in a modern author that took that would probably really emphasize that thing, that reversal of roles that's happening here.
Yeah.
I don't think that Heinlein is nearly using it quite that deftly, right? I don't think he's
And Oscar does he does not go to therapy to work through these issues.
he does not. He will fight many dragons to avoid therapy, as borrow the Twitter joke. So yeah.
There's one other thing that I just feel like is unforgivable, and you know, I'm laughing about it, but it's horrifying. And where at some point Oscar does something really kind for a young boy.
Yeah.
And she says to him, Star says to him, you know, I'm really impressed that you did that, because, you know, if you were doing that with a woman, I would think maybe you were trying to bed her. And he kind of goes, well, you know, and I'm like, and he, like, if there's some line like, well, in some cultures, you know, they're considered a delicacy. I'm like, No. We don't need to go there. Nobody needs that information.
We really don't. And it's again, it's one of those things that makes, I would never, you know, with a lot of older authors or older books, the Heinlein included, and I hate to keep going off on other books and other authors, but it's one of those reasons that I never, you know, emphasize, you know, in Something About Dragons or a canon of literature, even like going through the Hugos and stuff. Man, if you're a fan of science fiction and fantasy, you know, read what you want to read. Some of the stuff, you just, wherever you draw the line on your own particular thing. But yeah, he makes this joke about, like, you know, older men, younger men kind of thing, you know, 60s, you know, 60s joke about homosexuality. It's not really a joke, right? And it's just not, it doesn't land. It doesn't hit. I hope it didn't hit then. And it is one of those things, along with sort of the jokes about, you know, beating and rape, that will just, that ought to just whiplash you out of it a little bit. And you're kind of like, and anybody that gets to those points with Heinlein, and Inglory Road is not the worst example of Heinlein going down these roads. You know, no blame for anybody that reads that and goes, you know what, not for me. I'm not getting into that, you know, kind of thing. It's not the foundation of the book. Like, I have a lot bigger problems with folks like Edgar Rice Burroughs, for whom, like, racism and sexism is the foundation of what they're writing about.
Oh yeah, but eugenics, right?
Oh God, it's eugenics. Edgar Rice Burroughs and Heinlein is pulling from Burroughs, right? He's pulling from Barsoom, those adventure stories. You throw in a dash of pulp, and you got Glory Road. That's what it is. But you know, even if you like Heinlein, and even if you're interested in what he says in things like Stranger in a Strange Land or Moon and a Harsh Mistress, even here in Glory Road, you're still going to have whiplash from the fact that he is marinated in, you know, early 20th century sexism and stuff. And it pops out at the oddest time, or at the most inopportune moments of character development. And it makes
It's interesting too, because it kind of contrasts with some of the discussions about the commoditization of sex on Earth.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a really interesting discussion, because like you look back in the history of, dowries and bride prices and even the way, like, the Old Testament values women.
Exactly.
where you know, you are purchasing the sexual availability of this woman.
Into that family. Yeah.
Yeah. And her value goes down after her virginity is gone. Right. You know, and it's gross. And as somebody who reads the Bible, I'm like, it's gross.
And
it's interesting that Star says, well, yeah, there's no prostitution anywhere but Earth. Because of that lack of commoditization.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is you see Heinlein, even in hindsight, you know, at the time, you would definitely think of Heinlein as a progressive author. Now, we would definitely think of him as almost a regressive author. He's very much a libertarian in the right-wing sense of that term.
Right.
And so you do get these discussions, and you're like, all right, you're going the right, you know, I think you're going in the right way. And there's an interesting, like you said, interesting discussion of the oldest profession, you know, that kind of thing that comes up. I think it's a little, it's not a full universal, but it's definitely a universal sort of Western culture, however you want to say Western, you know, culture, but definitely some, you know, biblical basis, you know, Western Europe through the medieval period and ancient Rome, like that it's all there. And it's, you know, and that kind of sexism is absolutely there. And he pulls it in, and he keeps pulling from it, and he's just kind of marinating in it. And it throws you off a little bit. But he's, you know, you're seeing someone that's trying you know, this we're leading up to the hippie movement, right? We're talking 63, 64. So he's writing it in the early 60s. We're not quite, we haven't quite hit British invasion, right? We haven't quite hit full 60s as we think of the 60s, most of which happened in the 70s, but, you know, whatever. Yeah. But like, you are still seeing some of this cultural revolution starting to happen. And I think it's interesting that you see it in a mainstream author like a mainstream science fiction author. When dealing with these issues and really trying to write about them in what would have then been a very interesting, way and a very new, way to talk about the commodification of sex that's happening for teenagers and teenage, life in America in the late 50s and early 60s, sex, drugs, and rock and roll are just getting started, right? But then every now and then he kind of stops. He does what I always find with Highland is he stops short of taking it to its full conclusion because he just can't quite get – he's too much a generation back, I think. He's a person of the 20s and 30s, really. And he can't quite get himself fully into a headspace where equality means equality and not equality means, it's okay if I have sex with you. It's basically where he gets Highland,
Yeah.
And that's where he stops. And he stops in a lot of these areas. And it's a consistent issue in Heinlein's novels, even the ones that are progressive, quote unquote.
So anytime an author brings up a multiverse, right, or multiple planets, right, you always have the opportunity to ask questions about, well, how is Earth different, right? And this prostitution thing was one of the differences.
Yeah.
And I'm reminded of the Fountains of Paradise, where there's a probe that comes through and is able to humanity is able to ask it questions like, hey, do people believe in God on other planets? And he's like, some, but not many. And here they're talking about systems of government on these different worlds. And they're like, yeah, democracy happens, but not that often. And most of the time it's an autocracy of some kind. And the key to almost every, the answer to almost every leadership decision is, give it a little while.
Just wait.
Yeah, see what happens. Every now and then you have to destroy a world.
I always love that Heinlein, no matter what his discussion of politics, always comes back to military force. This is true. Moon is a harsh mistress, Starship Troopers territory.
With
Heinlein's idea of how government works. It's interesting too. Along the idea of this, he goes into Heinlein's obsessed with two things, and sex and politics. And so any of these asides that come up in his novels, it's always sex or politics. And when he gets into the political discussion, it does harken back to something we mentioned a little bit earlier, is that Heinlein is a student of classics. And I mean, classical literature is in Greek classics. And so he's really pulling from Plato's Republic and some Aristotelian thought there when he talks about democracy being a sort of dead-end form of government, right? He's really hearkening back to sort of Plato and Aristotle talking about oligarchy, autocracy and democracy, right? That tripartite system of the Greek city-states.
Yeah.
And, and they, Plato and the rest, watch democracy fail over and over again in this world of ancient Greece. And so Heinlein picks up on that, I think. And he was also so he's picking up that from the classical. And I think that he also, he was a bit of a disappointed New Dealer. Because he was a active sort of New Deal style. I think he ran for city council in California. He ran for some political office, and he was a campaigner. And so he was kind of a disappointed New Dealer. As he gets into his later years, and he becomes sort of a more libertarian. So he's sort of been he started as an idealist in the 20s and 30s. Himself and then became more disillusioned over time. So I think you see it come out with when he talks about the galactic, well, actually not galactic, universal and multiple universe form, the 20 big universe, 20 universes, I think is what they call it in the book. And when he talks about the government of her wisdom, his thing is just wait a while and you'll either all kill each other or, I'll blow up your planet or cut off your interdimensional travel. And that's a real swing in his personal politics, and a kind of, you go from the New Deal to the Cold War. And I think that explains a lot of Heinlein's political commentary in his books.
And there's another one of those things. If you've ever seen that meme of the person riding the bike and then reaching down and sticking a stick in their own spokes, here we have Star, who is the empress of these 20 universes, right? You know, that's amazing. A woman has power here.
Yeah, a woman has power.
Because, of course, she has hormone regulators, because otherwise, how could a woman fairly rule, right?
Oh, God.
Oh,
man, come on, dude. No, I just was thinking, it was like, there was one other sexism thing I was trying to, and it was that one. It was the one about, we don't let her have her period anymore, because you know how the ladies get, right? And I'm like, dude.
Seriously.
Come on, man. That can't be, we can't be talking about that. Like, have you met men? I'm just saying. Right. I'm sorry. We've convinced everyone that anger is not an emotion, so it's cool, right?
Like, he would say, but men more predictably suck. So
they're consistently terrible, and so and he does have, in addition to the weirdly sexist sidebar that he occasionally throws in there, he does have this thing where he talks about like the very pious emperor who is terrible. So Star, like when Star absorbs, you know, the memories of that particular emperor. She learns a lot from him because he was terrible and he did so much stuff. Now, not to put too fine a point on it or to pull any sort of rank, but I have a PhD in political science. And I studied a lot of politics, and this is not in any way, shape, or form how politics works. So anyone listening to this, please do not believe Robert Heinlein knows what he's talking about with politics. He really doesn't. At least not as far as the research is concerned. But he does, like, he wants, you know, I think at the end, when Heinlein gets into his political discussions, I think Gloria Rhodes is a really good example. He wants everything to be kind of as it is right now, but just a little bit better for him personally. And I think that that's not the most uncommon political outlook in the world, right? You know, and I think he's annoyed about taxes and foreign aid, which comes up like 3 or 4 times in the book from a very, from, let's face it, a main character who does not have a lot, like, does not have a lot of interaction with either taxes or foreign aid. He just spends all his time trying to make sure he doesn't pay any taxes. And that's it. And it's, like I said, he's not, you know, a great political thinker, I think, in some things, but he's pulling from some sources, you know, from some ancient sources, riffing on those, and then really try. And he, like I said, he's not the most uncommon political ideology, which is, I'm in a good spot and everything's kind of okay. I could be a little bit better for me personally, though. And that's probably the highest, best use of our political, you know, system. And you know, it is what it is for Heinlein.
Fortunately, nobody thinks like that anymore.
No, no one at all. Our politics are completely not like that at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that. Yeah, I think that is not, as like I said, not an uncommon thought. No,
I did think that the egg was an interesting idea, because, like you said, she's able to use this technology to kind of help her become a more able ruler, right? To learn from the wisdom of the people who have come before her. It reminded me of A Memory Called Empire.
Yeah, it's a good connection.
I didn't totally understand that. Like, she was at some point, he's getting frustrated at being a kept man, right?
He
has all the money he needs, but he's got no adventure in his life, and so he's really down.
I thought it was interesting. He keeps trying jobs and being just okay at them, and like, you know, I think that's that really encapsulates the Heinlein hero, right? Like, you can't just be pretty good at something, right? It's not, you can't do something for its own sake. You have to succeed and be really good at it, or really, you know, praised for it. And that's an undercurrent of that piece, and a sidebar, but I think it's interesting to watch Heinlein have his hero be just okay, and that be the real crisis of the latter half of the book. You were saying about the
yeah, and so he's kind of like, hey, you know, can we make a change here, go do something different? And she's like, well, I need like 30 years to finish studying the egg.
Yeah.
So can you entertain yourself for 30 years?
And I think that in maybe I'm selling Heinlein a little short here. You know, in a defter writer's hands, you might have found more Easter eggs about that length of time, right? Before you get the reveal that she conned him the whole time, right? That this was a long con by Star to get him to be the person that she needed him to be. And that she knew that he wouldn't stick around. Like, he just couldn't, like, it's not the personality. And she, you know, that part about the egg, right? Is like, she's like, well, I'm telling, you know, she, you know, what the best way to lie is with the truth. And she's telling you the truth. It's just that she knows you're not going to stick around for 30 years. No one can handle that. Yeah. Like, you know, I mean, 30 years ago, I was 13. I don't think that's, you know, I've changed a lot. I know, but it's interesting for Heinlein to use the egg and how it works and how it operates. Cause he's focused on, I mean, her title is her wisdom, right? Or his wisdom, if it were a man. And so Heinlein is focused on knowledge here. Like, that's what the egg represents, right? Experience, like learning without having to do, right? And I think it's interesting that he uses this, and he uses knowledge as the focus of the political power, right? He's convinced that if you have the right information, the right outcomes will follow, right? Mm-hmm. That if the ruler has all the information and knows what would happen, you know, knows the percentages and knows the likely outcomes of a decision or a change, then you would always make the right decision, right? I don't think that's actually right, but I think it's a fundamental part of Heinlein's view of what politics is, and the egg represents that, right? It's a MacGuffin full of knowledge, and he's giving it, you know, he's saying that, like, if you had this, you know, you would always make the right decision. And I'm like, that's not really how that works, but that's how he wants to believe that it works. And that's what that egg represents. And it works kind of interesting, of that impression thing. It's not just a library, right? It's an experiential thing. You, I think it's clear in the book that if you're the wisdom or the emperor or empress, you have to experience this person's life. You kind of go through it. You don't get to, you know, it's kind of a 360, you know, full submersion kind of thing. And I think that's an interesting piece of it, of like, knowledge is more than just the facts. There's an experiential aspect to it. So I think that's a piece of it that works interestingly for Heinlein in that particular
and way. And the other part of the 30 years was basically he's asking her, look, how long do you have to do this stupid job before you can retire and we can go adventuring again?
Yeah.
And she's like, well, 30 years.
30 years.
And that'll allow her to take on all the lessons from the egg and you know, be a just ruler and be able to find a replacement.
Be able to name her successor. Yeah. Because that's the crux of the thing that kicks off the plot, right? Is she Star is thrown into the wisdom's job unprepared, right? She's only impressed a couple of former emperors on it. So she's coming in half trained, right? And that's And that's I think, you know, you're half trained, you have an emperor, you know, you have to have an emperor in waiting, right? And actually this, speaking of, I mean, Heinlein, you know, really likes to show off his classical knowledge. That's an old Roman emperor thing, right? You had an Augustus and you had a Caesar, right? That was part of the Roman Empire. That was the way it was organized.
And the rule of two from the Sith, right?
Rule of two from the Sith. Actually, also, you know, I don't think maybe George is stealing from more places than we think.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see that, and that's what kicks off the plot, right? And having to have this succession training and the succession planning, I think, is an interesting part of that. And having to learn and be the ruler, and also in the face of the character, it's interesting that he presents her as a half trained and already this amazing, you know, Amazon ultimate warrior, ultimate ruler kind of thing. And I think that there's, you know, Heinlein is trying to get to this, you know, we talk about these like random flashes of pretty ugly sexism in Heinlein, but I think he is trying to set up as like, listen, you know, you may be viewing this from the point of view of the hero and you are empathizing with the hero. You were the reader, right? He's assuming that you're a young man in the 60s. You're empathizing with the hero, but realize a half-trained wisdom, like, just conned this guy for his entire life, right? Mm-hmm. And like, she is so far of a step above you as to be, you know, these are orders of magnitude difference between you and her. And I think he's trying to really, like you said, like there's a female ruler of the galaxy. It's a uncommon thing, you know, to think of in the 60s, but he is really trying to set up this dichotomy between two of them.
And she gets paddled by her husband when she reveals the plan.
Oh my God. I know. And I just, man, dude, did you just like, you were trying so hard, Heinlein, but you were really stuck in the 50s. It's just what it is. So yeah, he's doing his best, but he's not succeeding or even maybe most of the time.
Yeah. The audiobook was interesting. The version that I got was read by Bronson Pinchot. And Ruffo is presented as this very French guy, right? And in the book, in the print book, I noticed when he was talking about Star, she and her were always capitalized. And in the audiobook, he always says, when she, you know, and when her. And it was very interesting the way he just launched on every single one of those, really, really emphasized them.
Really hit. And that's right. Yeah, he does capitalize it throughout. She and her are capitalized. Mm-hmm. I bet he did a good job. I bet that he's a pretty good reader for this one.
Yeah, I thought he did an excellent job, actually.
Yeah. When you were saying, I haven't done the audiobook. I don't usually do audio fiction all that often. I do it sometimes. Mm-hmm. sometimes I'll pick it up for the library. I'll do audio fiction, but I have to, I'm trying to listen and I'm trying to be in the story. And when I'm driving or dishes or something like that, it always gets me. So nonfiction, I do much more audio. And yeah, so like, yeah. I have some people that swear by, you know, the guy that played, speaking of weird gender politics, the guy that played Spike on Buffy reads the Jim Butcher novels and apparently is quite good. Mm. You know, and
he is. Yeah. I've listened to a couple of those.
You've listened to a couple of those. Yeah. And they say he's very good. One day I'll get around to reading it, but I bet he did a good job. This is definitely one that if you wanted to perform it right, you could really sort of dig your teeth into it, I imagine. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I bet and despite, you know, everything that we've said about the regressive stuff in there it is a fun book, at least up until to that point where he starts gazing at his navel a lot about how he's got all the money in the world, but he's bored.
But he's bored. It's so sad.
Yeah. And so then he's got to go back to Earth and find that he there was some kind of like race ticket or something that he was able to cash in for a whole bunch of money. But then Uncle Sam took 80% of it.
Yeah. Sweepstakes. He gets a sweepstakes ticket and like it bumps him in the top tax bracket. Also, Heinlein does not understand how marginal tax rates work. So let's not go into that part.
Right.
He goes back to, and I think again, we are talking about like we are hitting a lot of the negative ports, and there is some regressive. Mm-hmm. You can't ignore it with Heinlein, but I think he is aiming at something here, right? He's at least aware enough to know that he has perfected this idea of the Heinlein hero, right? This person that is mm-hmm. excellent in everything. I mean, the character of Rufo is very obviously the character of Jubal Harshaw from Stranger in a Strange Land. It's just you could pick him. They're the same guy. They're the same character. Mm-hmm. And that character shows up quite frequently in Heinlein, and Oscar Gordon is an example of the sort of like, you know, really good at stuff Heinlein, you know, everything kind of Heinlein hero. And he is kind of trying to get at this concept of like, once you've done the achievement, right? Once you've made an ultimate achievement, you save the galaxy, right? You are Luke Skywalker, right? You know, and Luke Skywalker keeps having adventures. You are now stuck as the consort of the most powerful woman in 20 universes, right? And then when he tries to, and that's the sort of denouement part of the back third of the book, is he goes back to Earth and tries to get back into the life that he wanted for himself before he went to war, right? Before he went to Vietnam. And it doesn't work out for him because it's not what he wants anymore, right? And that's kind of what I was mentioning earlier, is this is a book about nostalgia, right? Is that like, you know, there's, you know, you can't go home again. And I think Tolkien, you know, just to hit my fantasy here, Tolkien handles that very deftly with Frodo, right? At the end of The Lord of the Rings, right? Mm-hmm. Which is prior to this, at least in its original publication, and then its paperback, it becomes more popular later. But like, you know, he handles that a bit more deftly of what war and combat and trauma actually, you know, do to human beings. And Heinlein is really not concerned with anybody that has any problem, you know. I think Heinlein would like, you know, what was the World War II general that slapped one of his soldiers that was suffering from
Patton.
The show? Is that Pat? Of course it was Patton. Mm-hmm. I was saying Patton or MacArthur, but I couldn't remember which one. But slaps one of his soldiers that's suffering from shell shock, right? You know, battle fatigue. They would have called it then PTSD, we'd call it now. Mm-hmm. You know, Heinlein has no truck with that, right? He thinks that's a failure of character. And that's really, I think, where this falls down, right? Is he's really trying to examine the after effects of war, but successful war, right? Like I became a hero, I had to experience things that were pretty horrific, you know? And so I think that's where Heinlein falls down when he's trying to do this bit.
Yeah.
Get that same car thing,
buddy,
that I had before.
Yes, we can, but we can do it tomorrow. Can you go climb in your bed? Thank you, bud.
We should probably wrap up.
I'll let you. Let's wrap up. Otherwise, otherwise future Seth's gonna be cutting half this, half these interviews. It's gonna be just nothing. But you could feel free to leave the occasional interruption, my 4-year-old, in if it works funny. But if it doesn't, please cut him off. Calvin would love to know that he's in something. But
excellent. Yeah, this is an interesting one. And, you know, like this isn't a book I probably would have picked up. I did not know that it existed. I had never really looked in and really dived into Heinlein's bibliography other than, you know, there's 6 of them on the Hugo and Retro.
Yeah, all Hugo his top Wars. Ones are on the Hugo, yeah.
Yeah, and I've read some short fiction and stuff. And so I'm glad that we settled on this one because it was a worthwhile reading it and great discussion, James. Oh,
thank you. I really enjoyed it. I think you've got some, you know, you're hitting, I think, the things that are interesting about Heinlein, right? The things that are interesting about Heinlein in Glory Road now are not the things that Heinlein thought were interesting when he wrote it. You know what I mean? There's
yeah.
there's aspects of the book that are interesting, both, you know, in its position within science fiction and even fantasy literature. I've actually thought about, I think I'm probably going to write about it on Something About Dragons when I get there. I haven't decided yet if it's going to be one. I can't read every book I want to read for that one, so I'm not sure if I'm going to spend part of it on Glory Road. But it's interesting in the context of where it was written, what it was written about, and how we read it now versus how it would have been read in 1963. And mm-hmm. so I think that that's where you get the most out of this. A lot of Heinlein novels and a lot of classic science fiction novels, honestly, is you read them not because you should read them as a canon, but as because it helps inform, you know, modern science fiction or other types of science, and you learn something about it, and you sort of are able to sort of start fitting pieces together. And I think I find that as interesting as anything about Heinlein and Glory Road.
Yeah. I think that'll suffice for final thoughts. So why don't we move into, like, if people want to find out more about your podcast, you know, where can they find you?
Okay. Yeah. So Something About Dragons, like I said, is a podcast about the history of fantasy in the 20th century. And I've decided to go chronologically. So I start 1900 and I read things like The Wind in the Willows, and I read The Wizard of Oz, and I talk a little bit about those. And then we go into Edgar Rice Burroughs and then the pulps. And so I find it really interesting. I really love the pulps. I'm kind of deep in the pulps right now. Some of the early stuff, C.L. Moore, Robert Howard, Seabury Quinn, like those are really, you know, great things to read. So it's all about fantasy and sort of how it develops over time in the 20th century. And you can find me at somethingaboutdragons.com. I'm trying to finish getting that all set up. There's a blog that goes along with every podcast. The podcast is on Spotify and all the major podcasts, so you can find it. So just look for Something About Dragons and you can hear me. You can hear me talk for 45 minutes about what I think about fantasy and where pulp paper comes from. So, you know, it's a very fascinating thing of why paper got cheap. So that had a lot to do with how science fiction and fantasy both developed was cheap paper. So, yeah.
All right. Well, James, this is an absolute pleasure. It was so fun talking to you about this book. So thank you so much for doing it.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Bye now.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.